You gotta use the right tools today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump is using tariffs to try and force America's trading partners to change their policies and to get countries like China to buy more U.S. products. This economist says, wrong approach.
They're using 19th century tools of tariffs and quotas to try to address, in some ways, 21st century issues.
Also, how Taiwan figures into the complicated U.S.-China relationship.
When China is unhappy about something the U.S. does towards Taiwan, they punish Taiwan. They do not generally punish Washington.
Plus, Mexican-American TV anchor Jorge Ramos on switching between his many identities.
Sometimes I'm Mexican, and sometimes I'm American, and sometimes I'm Chicano.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Welcome to you all. Let's start the show today with global trade. I know, it can all be a bit abstract, but this seems pretty clear.
We can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
China was one of President Trump's favorite punching bags on the campaign trail. New figures from the Commerce Department today showed the trade deficit with China declining sharply in the month of March, but it was still over $25 billion, and Trump doesn't like that. A U.S. team led by Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin arrived in Beijing today to try to find a better deal for America. Menzi Chin is professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. How much does our trade imbalance with China even matter? I mean, Trump seems to think it's existential.
Well, I think, first of all, I should go to the point that, you know, oftentimes people think about trade as sort of a war or something in which one side gains and the other side loses. In general, both sides are gaining, you know, in terms of entire countries. In terms of our trade balance with China, I mean, it's around $400 billion per year. And our total trade deficit with the rest of the world is $600 billion. So you might be tempted to say, well, it's a big, big deal. On the other hand, it's important to note, you know, we count numbers of imports from China as they come from China. But the things that are being sent from China incorporate a lot of content from other countries. So, for instance, the iPhone that's coming from China actually incorporates a lot of value added or content from the U.S. in terms of research and development and software, semiconductor chips made elsewhere within East Asia. So if you took account for that, in fact, the $400 billion trade deficit, if you thought about the value added, it might actually be halved.
Do you understand what Donald Trump's dream solution would be for trade with China?
I don't. I actually don't think that his team understands exactly what the ideal solution is. In some ways, the president's approach, or I should say the administration's overall approach, is kind of scattershot. They're using 19th century tools of tariffs and quotas to try to address, in some ways, 21st century issues. If you think about the biggest sanctions that we placed or are planning to place upon China so far, $50 billion of trade having sanctions on them, tariffs, that's based upon intellectual property rights theft and mistreatment and so forth. And what we're trying to do is apply tariffs to pressure them to stop doing that. Well, it's like sort of pushing at the wrong area. You want to target the problems with intellectual property rights more closely to where the violations are occurring. In some sense, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was an effort to do that, to strengthen intellectual property rights in favor of the U.S. all around East Asia in sort of a ring fence around China in order to pressure them to come into the community of countries abiding by intellectual property rights protections.
Instead, it seems Trump is issuing these threats to China. Do you think that's more bark than bite? And is that a problem or is it tough negotiating?
It's truly hard to say because the president says various things. His advisors say other things, you know, and it's not clear to me that the administration itself is united in their views. And that's particularly dangerous because, you know, if you think about this all being a game being played by the Chinese against the U.S., you've got to know at a minimum what your own interests are, what you want to get out of these negotiations. And the Chinese, if you want to have a chance of getting at a solution, it'd be helpful for the Chinese to know what the Americans want. And from what I can tell from press accounts, this is a sore spot. They're not clear why this Gang of Seven negotiators have gone to China. What are their objectives? And it may very well be the case that different people in this group have different objectives.
All right. Let's pretend then that they all have clear objectives. Is there a way to shift the trade balance? For example, requiring China to buy more natural gas from the U.S., if that is what they want to do?
Well, the recorded trade balance is $400 billion. It's just very hard for me to see how you can shift $400 billion worth of trade. At the margins, the Chinese government has a tremendous amount of sway on firms, partly because many of the firms are state-owned enterprises. But $100 billion is a big stretch. And so it would have to be, you know, protection, tariffs of some sort on our part. The other thing that they could do is they could let their currency move in a particular way. They could let their currency appreciate, and that might be something that could be of sufficient importance and magnitude to get you $100 billion over some time. $100 billion is a lot, though.
So what if the threat of tariffs actually turns into a reality and we impose billions of dollars worth of tariffs on the Chinese and they do the same to us? What then?
Well, I think what happens is, to a certain extent, some trade will be redirected. Some trade will be smuggled to evade the tariffs. So the impact then is going to be minimal. But to the extent that there's a reduction in trade between the U.S. and China, it'll just be the case that trade will flow from different countries at probably a higher price. So the impact will be mostly on, I think, consumers and the producers in America, for instance, who rely upon the cheap Chinese imports. Is there going to be a bigger macroeconomic impact? I don't think so, unless two things happen. One is there's greater uncertainty in the world because of a trade war between two major countries. And if other countries are caught up in the spillover of these tariffs, because, of course, the tariffs don't affect just the U.S. and China. They're going to divert trade to other countries, and those countries will then face pressure to try to protect their own industries. So that is what I think trade economists worry about more than just, you know, the direct impact from U.S.-China sanctioning each other.
And what about Americans' wallets? Does that just mean we're going to end up by paying more for a lot of stuff?
I think for those consumers who consume lots of imported goods, you know, and are shopping at Walmart and so forth, they will see, you know, a disproportionate impact.
Hmm. Yeah, so walking into the room saying, we want a better deal, can we trust the Chinese to negotiate a more equal balance to trade, or should there be an assumption that they're just not going to give anything away?
I think the Chinese are reasonable in the following sense, that they're willing to compromise on some issues, but some of their core issues, they're probably unlikely to compromise. They have this Made in China 2025 plan where they want to move up the value chain, you know, move their industries into sort of levels where they've got more value added, where they're producing more technological content. And that is viewed as something that's key. It's central to their development paradigm. It's unclear to me that they're going to give that up, which is a big deal, in order to get rid of these tariffs. So at the margin, we're going to have some movement. And maybe what could happen is both sides could say, we've achieved some aims, have a face-saving way out of this tit-for-tat retaliation, and move on from there. So it's sort of possible for us to come to a compromise, but I think it relies upon some degree of flexibility and knowing what your objectives are.
Menzi Chen, professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, thanks very much for walking us through this. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks very much.
Here's another story involving China and Taiwan and the Dominican Republic. Okay, bear with me. Earlier this week, the DR established diplomatic relations with China at the expense of its ties with Taiwan. What is the big deal, you ask? Well, now only 19 countries, 10 of them in Latin America, recognize Taiwan as a sovereign nation. The rest of the world, including the U.S., backs China, which considers Taiwan to be a part of its territory. Bonnie Glaser is the director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She joins us from Washington. So why did the Dominican Republic say it was choosing China over Taiwan?
Well, the Dominican Republic has had a growing economic relationship with China, like most countries in the world, and wants to expand that relationship, wants to get more capital and investment and trade opportunities with China. And Beijing has been encouraging countries to switch their diplomatic ties to Beijing and away from Taipei.
Right. 19 allies now, and many of them actually in the Caribbean and Central America. Politically, though, remind us what a provocative move this is, at least from the Taiwanese perspective. How did Taiwan react to this?
Well, Taiwan was not surprised. There have been ongoing efforts by China to try and woo away so many of their allies. But yes, Taiwan was both disappointed and I think angry. There was a reaction from Taiwan's foreign minister, for example, underscoring the fact that by stealing away allies, China actually undermines its efforts to improve relations with the people of Taiwan. The Chinese government says it actually wants to win over the hearts and minds of the people of Taiwan. And of course, this is counterproductive to China's goals.
What role did China play in all of this? Like, was China actively trying to convince the Dominican Republic to cut diplomatic ties with Taiwan? Was it in response to something?
Well, I think we have to look at this in a broader context. Yes, China does want to woo away some of these allies, but the reason really is that China is dissatisfied with the government in Taiwan, its unwillingness to recognize that Taiwan, in their view, is part of China. And then, even looking at it through a broader lens, Beijing is very unhappy about the strengthening relationship between Washington and Taipei. And we have seen some actions by the Trump administration recently. There was a passage of the Taiwan Travel Act by Congress. There were some officials that traveled from the United States to Taiwan, not unprecedented, actually fairly low levels, deputy assistant secretaries. Mm. But China's afraid of the slippery slope. And so when China is unhappy about something the U.S. does towards Taiwan, they punish Taiwan. They do not generally punish Washington. China has a very big tool set to try and punish and demonstrate its anger toward Taiwan. That tool set is economic, it's diplomatic, and it's military.
This also happened last year between Panama and Taiwan. Why are countries in the Caribbean and Latin America reconsidering their diplomatic relationships with Taiwan?
These countries, again, have growing economic relations with China. The Chinese are pursuing a very large global project called the Belt and Road Initiative. They've offered to include Latin America, and so they're offering financing, generally loans to countries in order to help build infrastructure. But in some cases, the Chinese don't always follow through with these pledges. So I would cite, for example, in 2007, the Chinese established diplomatic ties with Costa Rica and pledged $1 billion to build a refinery, $400 million to construct highways, and we really haven't seen follow through. But I think that a lot of these countries, whether we're talking about Panama, Dominican Republic, or others, they do see the potential for great benefits. But I think in large part, the Chinese are looking for not just the trade and the economic relationship. They want to build political influence so that if they need to put more pressure on Taiwan, that they can peel off one ally at a time.
So Taiwan lost ties with Panama last year. This week, it was the Dominican Republic. How big a blow is this for Taiwan, and what options do they have to try and prevent this from happening again?
It is a blow to Taiwan, and there is little that Taiwan can do to prevent this from happening. But I believe that Taiwan has very important partnerships around the world. And these are not necessarily going to lead to diplomatic alignments. But I think that Taiwan will continue to build and strengthen these relationships in areas where there's mutual benefits, even if it loses some more of its diplomatic allies.
Bonnie Glaser is the director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Just ahead, a North Carolina city tries to retain its title of furniture capital of the world here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. High Point, North Carolina, is known as the home furnishings capital of the world. For more than a century, many of our sofas, beds, and tables were made in and around High Point. But in the past 20 years, much of the manufacturing has shifted overseas to China and other parts of Asia. High Point still boasts the largest home furnishing trade show, though, in the world, and it's drawing a lot of international visitors. The World's Jason Margolis reports.
The population of High Point is about 110,000. Each spring and fall, it nearly doubles in size, with furniture buyers coming to scout the latest and greatest chairs, tables, and light fixtures. Tom Conley is the CEO of the High Point Market Authority, which runs the trade show. He says buyers began coming to North Carolina more than a century ago because the furniture was made here.
And the buyers would come down from the Northeast on a train, and they would go to the various factories. And somebody had the brilliant idea, that's not really efficient. And so High Point got really lucky, and somebody said, we're going to start an exposition center here. They call it the Southern Exposition Center. It was rather small, but many of the exhibitors took their product from the factory, put it in a showroom, and the High Point Market was born.
Sure. This is our to-the-trade lineup. And
today, the market spans 13 square blocks and nearly 12 million square feet of showroom. That's like having 114 average-sized Walmarts, bustling for 2 weeks a year and largely abandoned for the other 50. It's High Point's Super Bowl. Local hotels taken $140 million during the 2 weeks. Although the show here is the world's largest, international buyers need to make a choice. High Point or Milan. They happen at the same time. For nearly all the buyers from India, it's really not much of a decision.
As Indians, we're only exposed to Milan Fair because Italians are the only ones who know how to make furniture. That's the myth.
Smita Prakash chooses High Point. She and her partner Divya Jain run Spaces Design Consultants, an interior design firm in New Delhi. This is their fifth visit to North Carolina.
We fly from New Delhi, and from New Delhi we take a flight, either a direct flight to New York, so we take a hopping flight from Dubai or Detroit or London, whichever way.
All in, it's a long schlep to get to High Point.
Home to home is about 30 hours, so by the time you get to the airport, you fly in.
We walk inside the International Home Furnishings Center.
Good morning. Welcome.
12 floors of showrooms.
If it says C, you're in the commerce wing. If it says D, it's the design wing.
For the two Delhi designers, navigating all of this and traveling 30 hours, it's worth it. They're carving out a niche as people who can deliver American design furniture to India. That's their pitch. Still, Jain and Prakash say changing tastes can be tough.
American brands are right now not that popular.
But Indians still think of Italian brands as the pinnacle.
Absolutely. They still have a very preconceived notion of American furniture being bulky, traditional. You know, so Pottery Barn and the restoration hardware and the Crate and Barrel is what really registers as American furniture. For them, it's not about the nuances. It's pleasantly surprising when you walk into the market and see what is American furniture all about. It has really evolved.
There's another challenge with American furniture, logistics. Most American furniture these days is designed in America, built in China, then shipped to the U.S. If Prakash can fill an entire shipping container, enough to furnish 8 or 9 bedroom sets, she can have furniture shipped direct from China to India. But if the order is smaller, it needs to go from Asia to the U.S., then back to Asia.
It is cost prohibitive for sure.
By how much?
That's a secret we can't tell there.
But it is quite a bit.
Roughly anywhere from 30 to 50%, I would say.
Matthew Kim is with Universal Furniture, a company based in High Point. To put some numbers behind this, if somebody in Bangalore wants a $1,000 American design couch built in China but sitting in a warehouse in North Carolina, it could cost them $1,500.
That's being generous, too, I would say, just because of the freight costs from there, back, and whatnot. So.
Regardless of price, Prakash's mission is simple. Convince her Indian clients that American brand furniture stands out.
So building the name is a very, very important thing, and it's already built in certain circles, and then the word spreads. So this particular client would do his home, and I'm sure everybody that comes into the home would then go further and say, where is it from? How can we get this? And work from there.
It's not only Indians discovering American design furniture. Sales to Canada, the Middle East, and Mexico have been steadily on the rise. And a small but growing number of American design sofas and chairs are filling up some middle-class homes in China. For The World, Jason Margolis, High Point, North Carolina.
Jason's story is part of our 50 States Project. That's an ongoing look at how globalization impacts communities across the nation. And the idea for today's story, that's thanks to one of you.
My name is David McLean. I'm from Greensboro, North Carolina, and I listen to WFDD out of Winston-Salem.
We've been asking for your story ideas. If you think you have a story that would be good for our 50-state series, let us know, like David did. We've got a submission form at pri.org/50states. That's pri.org/50states. Send us your ideas. We just might come and visit. Let me take just a moment for a news update before the break. For a long time, the Basque separatist group ETA has been trying to shut itself down. Years ago, for example, it announced an end to its armed activity. That's what ETA called its decades-long record of assassinations and terrorist attacks in Spain. All told, that campaign left more than 800 people dead. But ETA did not get anywhere near achieving its goal of a separate Basque nation through violence. And this week, the group made it official.
ETA, Organización Socialista Revolucionaria Vasca de Liberación Nacional, quiere informar al pueblo vasco del final de su trayectoria.
That's from an audio recording obtained by the BBC, where an ETA member reads a statement announcing that the group has effectively ceased to exist. The announcement did not surprise many Spaniards or even many people in the Basque region itself, where the BBC's Tom Burridge went to gather reaction.
I mean, public opinion turned against this group in the late 90s after a series of high-profile assassinations. 7 years ago, it announced a ceasefire. It's been decommissioning weapons in the last few years via international mediators. But this statement confirms that the group is no more. But it also says in the statement that the ex-members of ETA, those who support the group, are now in support of the very goal that they've always sought, the creation of a separatist Basque state, and they'll do that now via democratic, peaceful means, and they have been in recent years. We spoke to one man whose father was assassinated by ETA in 1996, shot at point-blank range, and he said this statement is pure propaganda. That's the way it's seen by the Spanish government, and that's the way it will be seen by many people across Spain. ETA will always be, in their eyes, a terrorist organization that killed more than 800 people in a brutal campaign of violence.
The BBC's Tom Burridge in the Basque city of San Sebastian. By the way, Spain's Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy issued a statement of his own this week on ETA.
ETA puede anunciar su desaparición, pero no desaparecen ni sus crímenes ni la acción de la justicia para perseguirlos y castigarlos.
Rajoy said ETA can announce its own disappearance if it wants. What will not disappear, he added, are the government's efforts to bring ETA members to justice and punish them for their crimes. I'm Marco Werman. Univision anchor Jorge Ramos doesn't think journalists have to be neutral all the time.
Am I supposed to be neutral when the president of the United States makes racist remarks when he says Mexican immigrants are criminals and rapists? Are we supposed to be neutral in front of that? I don't think so.
My conversation with Jorge Ramos coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Jorge Ramos has been called the most influential news anchor in the Americas. He's the face of Univision's flagship Spanish-language news broadcast. Ramos was front and center during some of the most compelling moments of the last presidential campaign, like this press event in Iowa in 2015. Ramos and Donald Trump sparred over Trump's proposal to use mass deportations as a way to rid the U.S. of criminals.
No. I'd ask you a question. Do you agree with that? We have tremendous crime. We have tremendous problems. I can't deal with this.
At a widely seen event later in the campaign, Ramos again tried to press candidate Trump on his immigration policies.
Excuse me. Sit down. You weren't called. Sit down. Sit down. Sit down. Go ahead. No, you don't. You haven't been called. Go back to Univision.
That's when Trump called on a security detail to throw Ramos out of the press event. Ramos writes about how that moment changed him in his new book, Stranger, The Challenge of a Latino Immigrant in the Trump Era. Jorge Ramos, thanks very much for being with us. After then-candidate Trump had you ejected from that event, you had an interchange with a Trump supporter. Just recount that for us, if you would.
Yes, Donald Trump had said, go back to Univision. He really meant go back to Mexico. And I think hate is contagious because just a few seconds afterwards, after the bodyguard ejected me from that press conference, one of his supporters told me, get out of my country. And I told him, what are you talking about? I'm also a U.S. citizen. And that's exactly what's happening. You know, I've been living in this country for 35 years. Both my kids, Paola and Nicolas, were born here. I came here because of censorship in Mexico. I never would have expected that I would be ejected from a press conference in the United States. Something similar had happened to me with Fidel Castro when a bodyguard prevented me from asking questions. But to happen the same thing in the United States, it was unthinkable for me.
Yeah, I guess one could rationalize this as a press conference and these things happen from time to time, but then you have this guy tell you, get out of my country. How did that whole day make you feel?
Let me say something. I'm an immigrant from Mexico, and this country has been incredibly generous to me. I left Mexico when I was very young. There was a lot of censorship in Mexico. There was no democracy. And this country gave me the opportunities that my country of origin couldn't give me. I was censored in Mexico because I was criticizing the president. And my boss told me I couldn't say that. And at the end, I quit. And I left and came to this country. And when I realized that you could criticize the president here and nothing happens, I thought it was beautiful. Mm. So it's been like that for decades until Donald Trump came. And when he said that Mexican immigrants were criminals and rapists, I knew that he was lying. And he was talking about me. He was lying. That's fake news. And that's when I thought that as, not only as an immigrant and as a U.S. citizen, but that as a journalist, I needed to take a stand.
The subtitle of your book is The Challenge of a Latino Immigrant in the Trump Era. And I got to say, it feels like there are parts of this book where you feel the need to argue immigrants are really good people. What does that say about the times we're living in?
What we listen to almost every single day from President Trump and from his tweets is the idea that immigrants and foreigners and refugees, like the refugees that we have right now at the border between Tijuana and San Diego, that they're all bad hombres, that they're criminals. And the reality is exactly the opposite. Immigrants are less likely to be criminals and to end in jail than those born in the United States. Immigrants are here not because they want to kill Americans or they want to go to Disneyland. They are here simply because there are jobs for them and they are doing the jobs that nobody else wants to do.
Jorge Ramos, talk a bit about how journalism has changed for people of color and immigrants who are journalists in the Trump era.
I believe that as journalists, you are a journalist and I'm a journalist, that we have to report reality as it is, not as we wish it would be. So if something is red, we say red. And if 17 people died, we say 17. And I think everybody agrees with that. However, when it comes to certain issues, I think it is our social responsibility to question those who are in power and to give voice to the voiceless.
You do write about the need to stop being neutral, and it's led some people to call you an activist. How do you respond to that?
I'm just a journalist asking questions. But I don't think it is our job necessarily to be neutral all the time. I don't think so. Am I supposed to be neutral in front of a dictator like Fidel Castro or Hugo Chavez or Daniel Ortega? Am I supposed to be neutral when the president of the United States makes racist remarks, when he says that Mexican immigrants are criminals and rapists, or when he says that Josh Gonzalo Curiel cannot do his job simply because of his Mexican heritage?
You're talking
or when
about
he
the judge.
Said
yeah.
Josh Gonzalo Curiel, or when President Trump said that people from Haiti and African nations come from asshole countries. Are we supposed to be neutral in front of that? I don't think so. I think the best examples that we have of great journalism in this country have happened when journalists take a stand, when they stop being neutral. We can talk about Watergate or Edward Morrow during the McCarthy era or the Boston Globe in front of the Catholic Church and the cases of sexual abuse. I think the greatest example of the best journalism in our country have happened when we as journalists decide not to be neutral. And sometimes I do feel that we are under resistance, that somehow our job, our real job, is to make sure that people know exactly what's happening. Because if they were to listen only to President Trump and to his government, they would be getting a completely distorted image of what's happening in this country. And I think when my kids ask me in 10 or 20 years, hey, Dad, you were a journalist during the Trump era. What did you do? Did you resist? I can safely say that I resisted, that I said no, and that I asked questions.
But can you really be objective if you're part of the resistance?
When you have a president who constantly lies, a president who's making racist remarks, What are we supposed to do? Are we supposed just to report what he is saying, what his government is saying, without challenging that, without resisting, without saying, without telling our audience that is not true? And again, these are not normal times. And our role, let me just repeat that, it is to question those who are in power. We always have to be on the other side of power.
We learn a lot about you in your book, Stranger. You talk about accents and how your accent immediately tells everybody that you're not from here. Your accent, you say, is Chilango from the north side of Mexico City. Yeah. Tell me about your childhood and what your neighborhood was like and where you grew up.
You know, as an immigrant, I think you're always looking for home. And I realized that I'll never be home again. I grew up in Mexico City. And if you're from Mexico City, you're called Chilango. And I still have that accent when I speak Spanish. And, you know, believe me, I tried to get rid of my accent in English. But when you learn English late in your life, I really learned it when I was 24, 25. And my kids correct me constantly. It is simply not easy. But I think your accent reflects who you are. And when people listen to me, they know, hey, Ramos, he might have two passports. He might have a U.S. passport and a Mexican passport. And you can clearly know that I was not born in this country. You know, Sandra Cisneros, the wonderful writer, she told me that I am an amphibian. And I think she's right. I think I live in two worlds. Right now we're having a conversation in English, but just in a few hours I'll be doing a newscast in Spanish and then I'll be talking to my kids in Spanglish. And I go back and forth. I'm not only an amphibian, but I'm also a translator. I'm trying to translate the Latino and the Latin American reality to a English-speaking community. And then what's happening in the U.S. to an audience that feels more comfortable in Spanish. So I go back and forth. And sometimes I'm Mexican, and sometimes I'm American, sometimes I'm Chilango, and sometimes I'm Chicano. And, you know, sometimes I decide, I have dual citizenship. So sometimes I decide to be Mexican or American, depending on how long is the line at the Mexico City airport. that's the truth.
Why did you want to get rid of your accent initially?
So people can understand me. English is the language of power. If I'm invited to Fox News, some people might think that it's political suicide to go to Fox News. But I do that constantly because I think it is important to have a conversation with people who don't agree with you. When that man outside that press conference told me, get out of my country, those words were charged with hatred. And you feel it not only, you not only listen to it, but you feel it in your skin and it goes inside you.
Yeah, and it occurs to me that in an age when we talk about fake news and hate speech, the rationality of understanding the power of words is almost an existential concept. I mean, just compare Obama to Trump. Trump tweets from the hip all times of day. Obama, the opposite, almost to a fault. You could see the gears moving when he'd answer a question, a very careful lawyer mentality where every word matters. But you had big problems with Obama, didn't you?
I also criticized President Barack Obama. When the Democrats controlled the White House and both chambers of Congress, they had about 8 to 9 months when they could have approved immigration reform. And President Obama didn't deliver on that one. The other problem is that he deported more immigrants than any other president in the history of the United States, 2.5 million undocumented immigrants, destroying thousands of families. Granted, he gave us DACA, and he always supported immigration reform, and he never insulted immigrants. But my problem with Barack Obama was that he didn't deliver on his promise to introduce immigration reform and that he deported so many people that when election day came, there were about 14 million Latinos who decided to stay home because they were thinking, okay, should I vote for the Democrats? But they didn't deliver. And then, or should I vote for a candidate who's been making racist and anti-immigrant remarks? And at the end, 14 million Latinos decided to stay home on election day.
Yeah, look ahead, if you would, to future elections, because you write in Stranger how you underestimated Trump's ability to win the election while losing the Latino vote. So what did you get wrong? And also, what do we miss when we talk about the Latino vote as like one singular block?
Latinos are not monolithic. Think of this. There were about 13 million Latinos who voted in the last election, and 29%, about 3.6 million, voted for Donald Trump. So just think of what that means, that even within the Hispanic community, despite the attacks on Latinos and immigrants, more than 3 million Latinos voted for Donald Trump. That clearly says that we are not monolithic. There are many differences between new arrivals from Mexico and Central America and people from Puerto Rico who have a U.S. passport, or people from Cuba who, up until just a few years, they could become U.S. residents simply by touching U.S. territory. So that's one thing. And what I got wrong during the election is that I said many times that no one can make it to the White House without the Latino vote. And I was wrong. What happened? Well, 14 million Latinos decided not to vote. I was not listening correctly to the other Latino voices that were telling me, you know, we don't trust the Democrats. And I don't know who Donald Trump is, but I would rather try something new. It was my mistake. It's on me.
So let me end with this question, Jorge Ramos, kind of going back to that idea that all through the day you're constantly code switching almost between your Spanish newscasts and speaking in English and Spanglish with your kids, written English, Chilango Spanish. You drive home, you said, listening to MSNBC or a Beatles station. So what Beatles song do you turn to when you're feeling that moment like a stranger, a song that pulls you out of that feeling?
Well, in Mexico, I grew up listening to the Beatles, but actually in Mexico, we couldn't, talking about accents, I didn't call them the Beatles. That was too elegant. They were called Los Beatles. Los Beatles. So we were listening to Los Beatles all the time. And actually, you know something funny? Before I learned English, I used to sort of sing the Beatles songs in Spanish. it didn't make any sense. And I would just repeat words after words and didn't make any sense. And later in my life, I realized how beautiful those songs were.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah. When you listen to Let It Be, I had no idea what Let It Be meant. And then you would say in Spanish, Let It Be, Let It Be, Let It Be. And then if you and I still remember singing with my friends, Let It Be, Let It Be, Let It Be, which means really nothing, neither in Spanish nor in English. And then later in my life, I realized that it really meant Let It Be, which is just a beautiful sentence. But I used to do that with many other songs constantly. And somehow now I realize that part of my love to this country, and again, I've said this country has been incredibly generous, it started with songs in English that I had no idea what they meant, but that I constantly repeated in my mind in Spanglish in words that meant absolutely nothing, but that eventually I made peace with the U.S. by coming to this country and understanding that those beautiful songs that I was singing in English actually had an incredible meaning in English.
Univision anchor Jorge Ramos, his new book is Stranger, The Challenge of a Latino Immigrant in the Trump Era. It's great to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Okay, let's get back to random acts of kindness. We recently asked you to send in your stories of times when you either gave or received a random act of kindness. We asked because of Bren Bataclan. He's an artist we featured on the show not so long ago. And his acts of kindness, giving away his paintings to strangers, got us wondering about your stories. And now that we've read your tales, many of them super poignant, the time has come for Bren to give two of his paintings to you. Bren, great to see you again. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me again.
So, you know, no sooner did I make the first appeal to our audience at the end of our program a couple of weeks ago that we got our first response, like literally 3 minutes after we got off the air. And like I said, the responses we got on Facebook, so heartwarming and frankly overwhelming. Before we get to your two favorites, the recipients of your paintings, why don't you tell us first about one of the runner-ups, Mandy Henderson Burgess from Santa Barbara, California.
This I absolutely love, because she painted something and then she randomly mailed it to a house in Alabama. So I thought, I'm pretty random. That's just great. So I would love to hear back from that person who's like found that random art, you know, in the mailbox. It's wonderful.
What a story. So yes. She just, do you know if she just pulled an address out of thin air and just
I think so, yeah. She just randomly showed, yeah, painted, sent, wow.
I love that.
It's fantastic.
Talking about pay it forward. And then there was a story from another runner-up you liked, the Jackie Flewelling. And Jackie's story was about meeting someone in the Philippines, your home country. It's a man she encountered in a market there who basically laid bare his life story, a migrant from Peru, moved to Japan, met his Filipino wife there, then moved to the Philippines where he became a tricycle taxi driver. And you pick up the story from there.
Sure. So Jackie, and I'm assuming her partner is Filipino because she mentioned she's
right.
He's from the Philippines. So they were at their local farmer's market on a weekend having a great time. And they were approached by this person speaking Spanish asking for help. So it turned out, you know, he's from Peru, needed money. And they were hesitant at first because they even said they were jaded. But they were so moved by his story. So they have decided to give twice the amount. It was wonderful. And they felt this amazing high the whole day. And it's that kind of paid forward that is really important in my work. So That's why they became the runner-up, or Jackie became runner-up.
And establishing that simple human connection with a man they didn't know.
Yeah.
So we mentioned that your idea to give away your paintings, your random act of kindness, Bren, that started when you first moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts. It was a kind of a way to fit into the community. Just tell us more about how all that started and what the response was like when you first started doing this.
Sure. So I was in grad school in Ohio prior to moving here. And so I was like a Midwesterner, super, super friendly. So I would give eye contact, would smile at random people, and I didn't get it back. And so that kind of saddened me. So I said, you know, I will do my own street art project to spread more smiles around Boston. So at first I thought that folks here would say, hey, if you're not happy, go back. To where, you know, to San Francisco or the Midwest and be smiley there. But no, most folks here have said, we need this and thanks for doing it. It's over 15 years now, and I've given away close to 3,000 paintings.
Wow.
Yeah, so.
And all in the Boston
states,
area? Oh, all 50 states.
All 50 states and in about 70 different countries. So I just gave them away in Aruba. I was in Seattle 2 weeks ago. And this summer, I'm giving away paintings in Eastern Europe. So Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and possibly Finland, too.
You have a very stealth way of getting known worldwide. It's very clever and very smart. So as to your paintings, and we've got two of them in the studio with us that you brought in. Describe them.
Sure. Most of my characters are not really anything. So one is sort of like a thumb-like shape with a red baseball cap with a letter B. So I just like to hone in on their faces and their smiles. So like most of them are just headshots.
Yeah.
The other one's turtle, and that is a full-bodied creature. It's with legs, the shell, and head.
The style is very cartoon-like and very colorful. I mean, you could imagine seeing each of these as a frame in a comic strip almost, but they're just delightful.
Yeah, I grew up watching anime in the Philippines, so that's a big influence in my work.
See that, yeah.
Yeah, most have big eyes because most anime characters, so human beings at least, have huge eyes. But mine, most have one big one, one little one. I don't know why I do that.
So given that it comes from an anime inspiration, do you see this as pop art or is it just Bren Bataclan?
Both, because, you know, they are really pop art, like Murakami's work and Roy Lichtenstein.
Yeah, Murakami and Roy Lichtenstein. I see that. So let's get to the two listeners who will receive your paintings. First, listener John Stewart, not that John Stewart, from Salt Lake City, Utah, and he listens to us on KUER. What was his story?
Well, you know, his is one of the first entries, and even though we received hundreds of comments, that one really stuck to me. He is a professional Santa Claus. One of his gigs, he received twice the pay, and he was really moved. And so he and a friend, they were at a restaurant, and the waitress kind of overheard this nice story, and she started to share her life's challenges and how she had to tell her son that Christmas is not going to happen this year because of her chemotherapy and lack of salary and payment.
Right.
And so he said it was sort of like a bolt of lightning, like a big kind of sign saying, you know, I got twice the pay. I should give half that pay to her. And I started crying. A lot of these stories actually made me weep because they were so moving.
That was my feeling, too. A few hankies were needed to get through some of these stories. Yeah. And then there's also the story of Ruth Deakins from San Diego, who listens to us on station KPBS. Basically, she befriended a homeless man in her town that she sees all the time. He lives in a tent along a river wash. Anyway, he's suffering partly from dementia, and he knows he has a social security number, but doesn't know how to apply for benefits. Turns out she spent like a day with him at the Social Security office. Yeah. He should be getting $1,600 a month, and he didn't know this. The problem is that he can't prove he's a U.S. citizen. So now Ruth is trying to kind of figure out what to do next. But she's already committed to this man. And it's a sweet story that doesn't quite have an ending yet, although it does kind of fit in a theme, a larger theme from letters we got from listeners of stories about immigrants and how people are helping. How did this story speak to you? I mean, you chose it as one of your favorites.
Well, as an immigrant, it really resonated. And, you know, it's a scary story because he's been here for decades, and he's just missing some key documentation in order to forget his Social Security. So as an immigrant, I know folks who, you know, have similar challenges. It really, I just felt for that guy and also for the person who's helping him.
So two great stories for two of your favorites, among many great stories. And if you want to read more responses from our listeners, just go to The World's Facebook page. Bren, thank you so much for doing this with us.
Oh, thank you again.
Artist Bren Bataclan, and thanks to all of you for sharing your random acts of kindness. They were inspiring and a reminder that there are a lot of good and decent people out there. As always, thank you for listening. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.